Yeah.
This is The Impromptu, a multifaceted show discussing how technology, art, design, and equality converge on topics that matter most to us. From gaming culture to film and other forms of media, we examine the creative process and how the decisions we make shape our perceptions and lives. And now, your hosts for today, Michael Norton and Alex Knight. So, Michael, what's going on this week? We're back in the studio.
Today, lots of gaming stuff happened. We got the new hard mode for the King's Fall raid in Destiny. Assassin's Creed Syndicate is out for all those who really, really want to run around Victorian England and kill people and hijack stagecoaches.
Is there a market for that?
I don't know. Possibly. Guild Wars 2 just launched their new expansion, Heart of Thorns. Really smooth launch. They've already released like 4 different bug fix patches. And it's pretty much gone off without a hitch. No major server disconnects, no explosions. Everyone's just going through the content and having a great time, which pales in comparison to World of Warcraft's unfortunate Warlords of Draenor launch, if anyone recalls how that went.
I only played that game for a very brief period of time.
Yeah, I was never really a fan of it. It just focuses too heavily on the grind and repetitive action. It's like, go to a new area, kill this many things, get these things, rinse and repeat. It never really appealed to me. I prefer MMOs that kind of try to do things differently. So Guild Wars 2, I mean, I'm a huge veteran. I've been playing since the Guild Wars 1 betas. The thing Guild Wars 2 does is they've added dynamic world events to everything, and they've amped that up even further in Heart of Thorns, because now you're interacting in this multi-level jungle map with a day and night cycle, and things will actually happen during the night or during the day, and based on how well you do, the entire layout of the jungle, where the enemies are, where your allies are, that'll completely shift. It really keeps things interesting. Like, you're basically running around and stuff is happening all around you. I haven't gotten into too much of it yet. It launched at midnight, so I only played for a few hours, but it seemed pretty good from what I've seen. I also played on a few of the beta weekends that have been leading up to the launch, and it's been really fun. They also added a number of elite specializations for each class. So it's like a prestige profession that kind of layers on top of what you already have. So for example, the necromancer, which uses death magic and can summon minions that are like giant corpse heaps or skeletons, their specialization is called the Reaper. And they gain the ability to use a greatsword, which is a two-handed sword, and use it to channel really creepy chill magic and fear and a bunch of other stuff. They continually describe it as the serial killer from a slasher movie specialization. You become slow-moving, but you can pull enemies towards you and then slow them down so they can't escape and do heavy damage with the sword. Each class, they kind of did a lot of variety for each one. So necromancer got the Reaper. The mesmer, which is kind of the support and mob control class, they can like do area-wide condition damage and all sorts of other things. They got chronomancer, which gives them time magic and enables them to speed up allies, slow down enemies. Their ultimate power is essentially a time paradox. So normally a mesmer can cast illusions, which are copies of themselves that do attacks. So you can summon a bunch of illusions, pop them all. You can detonate your illusions to do damage. So you can detonate them. And now with the chronomancer, you can actually activate the skill that reverses the flow of time, and suddenly everything you had comes back and you can use it again. So yeah, just kind of across the board, every class kind of got something new to play with mixed reviews. Like over the beta weekends, players gave a lot of feedback and they've made changes, but some of them players still aren't happy with it. So I figure over the coming months, they're going to be rebalancing things as time goes on, just based on feedback and how well it plays in PvP and world versus world. They've also made the game a lot more compelling for pro pro gaming. They've added sort of a world championship sort of thing. They actually did a deep dive on that whole system. Like, basically anyone in the game can join up, and there's like a global ranking for the best players or the best teams, and they've just done a ton of work. I think they also have Twitch integration with that, so you can actually watch matches in real time, which is cool.
Isn't this a very old game? Because I thought did they make a sequel? Because I remember, yeah, Guild Wars, which was like, isn't it like a 10-year-old video game?
Oh yeah, Guild Wars 1 has been out for a really long time now. Guild Wars 2 is only about 3 years old. And with Heart of Thorns, this is like the big new shift to the game. Simultaneously, they made all of the previous game content free. So anyone can actually go to guildwars2.com and sign up and play the base game for free. Free accounts do have a few limitations. They don't get access to the daily login rewards. They're only allowed to use the trading post under certain restrictions. Like, basically, there's things that prevent gold farmers from setting up bot accounts. Like, they had to do a bunch of stuff to prevent that. It's constantly an issue, because the Guild Wars 2 economy is a wildly fluctuating beast. And gold farmers constantly threaten to throw it into chaos, as with any MMO with a semi-realistic economy based on resources. So yeah, I'm excited to see what else is in there. They also introduced raids to the game for the first time. There's at least one raid, and I think they've talked about two or three more. So that should be really exciting in terms of like late stage end game content. They also didn't raise the level cap or introduce some new tier of gear, which is really nice of them. They've basically said they want people that have gotten to the end to just continue enjoying this content. And to that end, they've introduced a brand new system called the Mastery System, where players who have reached level 80 can fuel their experience into additional abilities called Mastery Abilities that end up helping them in the metagame. So like in Heart of Thorns, you have a Heart of Thorns Mastery track where you can learn new glider abilities. You get a glider to fly around the jungle, because the jungle is three levels. There's a canopy, there's the middle ground, and then there's underneath everything, the roots of the trees and things. So you have to use the glider to kind of get around. So the first tier of that is getting the glider in the first place. The next tier is learning to use updrafts to renew your glider bar and keep flying around and so forth. There's also mastery tracks about learning various indigenous race languages and being able to unlock hidden paths and that sort of thing. It's basically just a really cool way of letting players sort of progress without needing to grind against this level bar. So like all the content is available. It's just a matter of exploring and getting through it. Like, you're not gated by, you need to be level 90 now and have exalted armor. Like, they're not moving that carrot. They're saying the carrot is still here, but then there's an entire farm right behind it.
It always seems to be like a running theme with any kind of game where there's a system where you have to level up your character, and it always seems like game developers are fighting to strike that balance, because, you know, obviously you need to level your character up in order to gain new abilities, to progress further, to do more interesting battles or raids or what have you. I mean, Destiny is a perfect example of that. And actually, I think Destiny is one of the better sort of games out there with an MMO element that strikes that balance. You know, they did a lot of work in the 2.0 patch to eliminate some of the more tedious stuff, and it sounds like they still have some more work to do. But It's interesting to me because there are, you know, you mentioned World of Warcraft earlier and how that just seems to be a giant grind fest. And I've certainly played my fair share of games that had excessive or what I felt was excessive grinding. And so I don't understand why this is still such a problem. Do developers not see that as a challenge? Do they not recognize that a lot of people find that kind of stuff frustrating?
They do, but at the same time they don't care because it's basically Skinner box game design. It's like, we will trap these players in this loop of, you need to get better to get this new stuff, to be able to do more, to be able to win more stuff that gets you more powerful. Like, it's this never-ending chain of constantly needing to be in the game to keep playing to get the next reward. So, like, they keep moving that carrot and keep moving it forward so that you never get to the end. There's always some new thing to attain. There's always some new reward to unlock. And it just keeps going and going and going. Like Destiny, before 2.0, you had to do the raid to get to max level, to be able to do the raid in hard mode, to be able to like do all the content. Like, all the end game content basically relied on the fact that you would be max level to make it easy. Like, a lot of the content literally was too difficult if you weren't the highest level. And the only way to get to the highest level was by having the armor and stuff in the first place. Post 2.0, it's a little easier, but I would say that element is still sort of there because as of King's Fall hard mode, the max light level is now 320. I'm not sure how much bearing that's going to have on the current content. But based on what they're doing now with microtransactions with the new emote store, the assumption is that they're going to be releasing new content soon that will probably be more difficult than the raid. I think they are still kind of moving it forward, but at the same time, when that content does come out, I have to assume that there will be a way to get armor and weapons that get you to that light level when you're doing it without having to do the raid, potentially. But for now, the only way to get there is to do the raid.
Let's touch on Destiny a little bit. We've talked about it since the 2.0 patch came out and the Taken King expansion came out. I've noticed that you've been playing that game quite a bit since it's come out. How do you feel about it now that you're several weeks into it? Do you still feel as positive about it as you did when that patch launched? Have you noticed any other things that are still frustrating you, things that linger from the first initial release?
I think I'm enjoying it a lot more. I've basically reached the end game at this point. I've nearly done the raid. We kind of wiped on Oryx and then weren't able to keep trying, but we got through most of the raid the one time that I played, which was really fun. Got a few rewards out of it. Didn't get any weapons, but I got two armor pieces. I got a ghost shell and the class item, which was cool. So now I'm at 299 light. The previous maximum before hard mode came out was 310. So I'm kind of nearly at the very top of where you can be in the game currently. But even then, there's still more to do. Like, the past few weeks have kind of revealed these time-gated quests for new exotic weapons. It all started when players found out that there was a secret entrance to get the sniper rifle by clearing a ship of enemies in 10 minutes. I actually managed to do that last week, which was cool. And then a quest finally unlocked to get the exotic fusion rifle sleeper simulant, which is this giant laser cannon that fires a red laser that bounces off of surfaces, pretty much decimates bosses. It's really cool, but very limited ammo. It's only got a magazine of 7 rounds, so you kind of have to bank it and only use it when you're about to do a boss fight. So it kind of has limited utility, but it's still pretty cool. And then this week, we finally got the unlocked quest path to get the exotic pulse rifle, No Time to Explain, which is the exotic version of the Stranger's Rifle, which we got at the end of Vanilla Destiny. And it has a perk where if you make precision hits, so headshots and stuff, ammo will literally return to the magazine so you can keep firing infinitely as long as you're landing headshots. So they've kind of hidden stuff. It's not clear exactly how much is yet to be revealed, but it's kind of kept the game going because every week it turns out that there's this new secret thing hidden inside of it. So there ends up always being something to do. At least so far. Time will tell if they're able to maintain that momentum.
You know, one thing I've been thinking about this week, as far as the PS4 is concerned, is, and I don't think we've talked about this too much, or if at all, actually, just trying to remember, but since the PS4 came out, I mean, and at this point, it's what, 2 years old now?
Yeah. Nearly three, I think.
Yeah, okay. What do you think of the user interface? Because it really hasn't changed since it came out, and it's a step forward. I think everyone will agree it's a major step forward from the PS3 in terms of responsiveness. There are things that I like about it, but in comparison to the frequent iteration that I'm seeing Microsoft do with the Xbox One, really is lagging behind. I don't feel confident that Sony has the caliber of design that Microsoft is having right now in their console department. There's a lot that leaves to be desired.
Yeah, definitely. The thing with Microsoft is they build software for a living. Like, and now they're getting into hardware. I mean, they did start with hardware with the Xbox, but now they're really getting into it with the Surface Book and the Surface Pro 4. Ultimately, they just have way more experience in building interfaces than Sony does. I mean, the only user-facing interface that Sony's really done is either the PlayStation or one of their Bravia smart TVs.
No, let's not talk about TV software. We all know what a
it's all terrible
bag of hurt that is.
Luckily, a solution to that is coming out on Monday.
Oh, really? What would that be?
The new Apple TV.
Oh, okay. It's finally upon us.
Yes, you can pre-order it starting Monday.
Very nice. Will you be getting one?
Oh, yeah.
Which configuration?
Probably the 16 gig to start.
That's what I was thinking of doing because I don't really have any intention of running games or many apps. It's like, it's for me, it's an entertainment box, right? Yeah. Streaming.
Netflix and other stuff, exactly. Like, I don't know how, like, maybe if the Apple TV app community takes off and there's just some really cool stuff out there, maybe I'll upgrade to a 32 gig. But to start out, I think I'm going to go 16 just to see how it goes. But we're getting sidetracked. Yeah, so Sony, they don't do a lot of interfaces. So I don't know that they really have that capacity to sort of iterate and actually go, okay, how can we make this really awesome for our users? They have designers there. I don't know what their situation is. That, like, I don't know if they have the ability to really look at this thing and go, this is crap, we need to do better.
Well, yeah, I mean, just look at the icons. I mean, when I look at the PlayStation, actually, I think it may have been the big 3.0 update, but I noticed that they changed the icon for the PlayStation 4 from what was actually a decent icon in terms of, like, at least it matched the rest of the OS. It was like translucent. And, you know, but then they changed it to this really ugly, I mean, I know it's their brand, but it's not like a blue square with the word PlayStation on it. Yeah. And so I use one of the built-in dynamic themes, which is just a red background that moves. So this, like, now with the red background and this square that's blue, I mean, it looks junky. There's no taste at all in the design. I mean, it doesn't feel good.
Yeah, they're really sold on that cross-media bar, but it just doesn't work. Like, I have so many games on my PS4 now that it takes nearly a minute to scroll across that thing just to get to what I want. It's really bad.
Yeah, so, and how do you scroll through games on an Xbox One?
So that, you actually have a library list that you can get to. You can also pin games to the first page, but that's kind of going away now. There is the new Xbox experience update that they're going to be rolling out next month. It makes it more like Windows 10.
So tiles, is that what it's going to be?
I think partially, yes, but you will also have access to a list of all of your games and apps. Like it'll actually be a jump list that you can access directly from the main menu, kind of like Windows Phone. So you can like press a button and then you'll just get this list of everything you have installed or everything you purchased, which is pretty cool.
Well, the PS4 has a library option that, and it seems to automatically hide games that you're not playing. But again, I mean, it's
all the way at the end of the list.
It's all the way at the end of the list. And so if you are playing a lot of different games at once, then you still have to end up scrolling a long time. I don't know what's going on there. They need somebody with a strong design and product vision. I don't know who that is.
Yeah.
But it doesn't, they're not really moving the needle on the design, which is really disappointing because the hardware is really, really exceptional. And I just was really hoping for something really fresh.
Yeah. Sony needs a Johnny Ive.
I don't know if that person even exists, but anyone who can even tap into a small portion of that kind of focus, that kind of someone who has that level of taste and knows how to make a cohesive product, they're hard to come by. Why don't we move on to some other stuff? There's a lot to talk about in the TV world. If you've been listening to this show for a while, you probably know that we've talked about, things like, equality in various different industries. And, you know, one of the things about TV shows, especially superhero shows or superhero movies, is just look what is out there and what's available in it. And it, you know, it tends to, lean heavily towards, white, muscle-bound superheroes, and they're all kind of the same. There isn't a lot of diversity happening in there, and I understand that they're all pre-established characters. That's fine. But there are female superheroes, and the fact that, you know, we haven't really seen, for example, a Wonder Woman movie, I mean, you can just go look up Wonder Woman on Google, and you can find, like, just the sort of tumultuous history that has had in terms of trying to get a movie or a TV show made properly, and you'll see what we're talking about. But there is a new show coming out on Netflix from Marvel. I don't know if it's the same people that are involved with Daredevil, but it's Jessica Jones. Now, I know it seems like you know more about Jessica Jones than I do, Michael, because we talked about this prior to starting the show, but I had no idea who this character is, but I did see the trailer. It does look interesting. It looks noirish. It looks dark and gritty. So it seems intriguing, and I'm definitely going to give it a shot, but I don't know. What do you think about this?
I think it looks really good. It might actually be better than Daredevil. So Jessica Jones is kind of a flawed superhero. She gains, like, canonically in the comic book, she, in the run that I think they're basing this show on, Alias Jessica Jones, she gets her powers from sort of a military experiment. She used to be a soldier, and she kind of washes out. Like, she's got these powers, and she just kind of can't hack it, and becomes an alcoholic, and she decides to open a detective agency in Hell's Kitchen. And through various events, she meets another superhero, Luke Cage. He's going to have his own show after this one. So it all kind of ties together with this narrative thread. I'm sure Daredevil will probably show up at some point.
I was going to ask if you would think that maybe they would do some kind of crossover with Luke Cage. It kind of makes sense to do this cross-pollination with all these Marvel properties.
And in fact, it's inevitable because they're all going to be on the same miniseries, which is going to happen at the end, called The Defenders, which is like, it's a street-level Avengers made up of all of these characters. So Jessica Jones, Daredevil, Luke Cage, Iron Fist, they're all going to be part of The Defenders. So once each individual series is rolled out, then the miniseries happens, they all get together, and then the next season for each show starts. Although Daredevil season 2 is happening before that, so I'm not sure. And then I think they're all going to be in Avengers Infinity War, which is going to be the largest collection of superhero characters ever assembled on screen at this point.
I don't know how they're going to manage that. That just seems insane.
Yeah.
Like, how do you balance your screen time with all of these characters?
I really don't know, but I think if anyone can manage it, it's the Russo brothers. Because they stitched together Winter Soldier perfectly. every character got just the right amount of screen time, just the right amount of character beats. They threaded that needle really well. So I'd like to think they'll be able to do a good job. They're certainly well equipped for it. They've done a lot of work with ensemble casts. They did a lot of work on Community, for example, so they know how to handle a large group of people. Hopefully that scales up to like 20 or 30 superheroes. The choreography is definitely going to be interesting. Everyone fights Thanos at the same time. Not all of them. Some of them will probably hang back with laser cannons or something. I don't know.
I don't see a listing on IMDb for who is directing this TV show. I see it says created by Melissa Rosenberg, who apparently was a co-producer on Dexter, but I don't really know of her that much. Oh my God, she worked on that terrible Birds of Prey series. Let's pretend that didn't exist.
Yeah. Well, some other people connected with that show have worked on other stuff in this space that's been good. So
she didn't write that show.
Yeah,
so
we'll give her the benefit of the doubt. Yeah, I don't know. These shows are probably the most interesting thing happening in the Marvel cinematic universe right now. The movies are the movies, but with these shows, they're really getting the opportunity to kind of show this darker, grittier side of the Marvel universe, which is really cool because it's not geared for all audiences. It's geared for a more mature audience, which means they can show more things, they can do more things, they can get away with more. Like in Daredevil, Kingpin smashing that guy with the door. That would never happen in a Marvel movie.
Yeah, that was
ever.
Absolutely brutal, but it suited the character.
Oh, yeah. And that stuff happens in the comic books all the time. It's like the movies kind of have to be these PG-13 everybody movies, but then the shows can be more like the source material. I mean, that's not to say all of the comic lines are really dark, but some of them are. And the Netflix shows can kind of allow some of those characters, some of those comic lines to be true to the source.
All right. So it looks like the show's coming out soon. I see a release date for November 20th. Now, Supergirl, that show is that show out now?
Possibly.
It's supposed to be airing on CBS, I think.
Yeah.
Now, a lot of people have been talking about that show, and it seems to be, at least, I don't know if this is just from fans of the comic, but it seems like the reactions are a bit polarized. On the one hand, we have people that are super excited about this for various different reasons. A, it's great to have a female lead, and B, you know, it looks like a fun show. But then on the other hand, I see people being super critical about it. Now, I don't know. I saw the trailer and I don't have a problem with it. It doesn't look cheesy to me. I mean, it does look like it's like they're aiming for a lighthearted sort of feel. It's not supposed to be dark or anything. So I don't know. I mean, it remains to be seen how good it actually is going to be. But at the very least, I mean, it is good that Supergirl is getting her own TV show. And, you know, I wish them all the best, and hopefully it turns out to be successful. But what did you think of it when you saw it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not gonna completely hate on it. I think it could work. I think the problem is that they're walking a very fine line when it comes to how lighthearted it is. I worry that they're kind of veering too far into this Hannah Montana-esque sort of thing where it's like, ooh, look at Kara Zor-El. She's this high-powered fashion intern. Yeah, and then she fights crime. All right, like just this kind of sappy, saccharine, really ridiculous sort of thing. Like, Superman can be kind of like that a bit, but it never goes overboard like that. And I worry that this show will go there. They'll just go too far into that place of, let's all just have a really great time and be totally G-rated and yeah.
Yeah, I see what you're talking about based on based on the trailer alone, I kind of got that impression too. So that is a bit of a concern for me, but we'll see. Because, I mean, yeah, they're going to have to walk that fine line of not just making it this. I don't know if she's supposed to be like a small town girl kind of dealing with typical, like, you know, trying to find romance while figuring out the superhero aspect. Because that's kind of a trope by now.
It feels like a ridiculous, like, part of it feels like this ridiculous romantic comedy trope with superpowers stapled onto it and the Superman brand. Like, in most of the comic arcs, like Kara's origin is, she's a Kryptonian citizen. Like, she's highly intelligent, grew up on Krypton, has all of this knowledge of this incredibly powerful race, and she ends up in a stasis pod and gets shot out into space. There's like various things.
Does she actually know who she is and where she came from?
Yeah. Canonically, she grows up on Krypton and she ends up on Earth. She gets put in stasis. In some of the continuities, she ends up on Earth a really long time ago, and Kryptonians live quite a lot longer than we do because of the sun and everything. So I think they're effectively immortal on Earth because of the yellow sun or something. But anyway, she arrives in like tribal times and just kind of survives all the way through. And in some cases, she's been instructed to look out for Kal-El when he eventually arrives, that sort of thing.
Wait, so she arrives in tribal times. Like, how... I'm no expert on Kryptonian lore, but, like, how long do these people live? They're not immortal. Don't they age?
They're not, but the thing is, with the yellow sun, they become super beings. So they get charged up, and they end up effectively immortal, as long as they're bathed in the rays of a yellow sun. Because Krypton's a red dwarf, they don't have that power. So growing up on Krypton, they grow up, they grow old, they die, etc. But because of the yellow sun, it kind of upturns the natural process a bit. I would assume they do live longer than humans, or did. But yeah, the yellow sun just kind of supercharges everything. So yeah, this seems a little odd. It's more, they're kind of going more like she suddenly appears after Man of Steel under some circumstance. And it's funny because Man of Steel actually sort of hinted at her arrival. That ship that Cal finds in the Arctic, there's an escape pod missing, and it's kind of implied that she's supposed to be in it or something. But they never kind of went with that thread. So they might be ignoring that for this show. It might be just like her ship arrives and he's supposed to look after her or something. And in some continuities, that is actually what happens. In some continuities, she's there before him, but in others, she arrives after he's already established as Superman and Clark Kent, and he has to look after her like she's his, like, precocious, bratty cousin who's always getting into trouble and stuff. So I think they're kind of going for that angle, but I'm kind of worried they haven't really captured the character.
So when you were a kid, did you ever watch Power Rangers? And I know you're a lot younger than me, so you probably were not of the generation of the original Power Rangers that aired in, like, 92 or 93.
No, I was 2 and 3 at that point.
So they are, you've probably heard over, I guess, the last year or so, they've been trying to reboot that Power Rangers series, and it looks like it's finally going to be made into a movie. And they've been releasing photos today on Instagram of some of the new Power Rangers. I'm intrigued by it. I mean, all we've got so far is just profile shots of who these people are. But I'm very curious to see what direction they're going to go in. Obviously, for this movie to be made in the first place, they would have had to be backed and have the support of Saban Entertainment. I know they very closely guard that property throughout all the series. All the people that have made that show, there is a specific formula that they kind of follow, in that the show has to be very lighthearted. In addition to the action and stuff like that. But one thing I've been clamoring for as an adult, I would love to see a rebooted Power Rangers that takes some of the fun aspects of it, because I don't think you have to lose that, but it would be nice to see something with a higher budget, with better monsters that don't look like people and just in a puppet suit and their mouths don't even move.
Yeah.
It's always been very low budget, and I would just, more than just the special effects, I would actually like to see these characters, these young people, have real personalities for once, whereas they seem to be facsimiles of what teenagers really are and how they actually behave. So it'd be nice if you know, they weren't so perfect at everything that they did in E. Like, they're all perfect students and they don't seem to have any troubles. A little more diversity in the cast and, you know, having them trouble would be good.
I'm just kind of thinking now, like, ooh, Power Rangers, the next generation. They take selfies and Snapchat and, like, they just literally take a selfie after defeating a bad guy.
That's what I don't want.
Yeah, I know. But I kind of feel like they might veer that way if marketing producers get their way. No, I think it is a really good idea to add diversity, to add character flaws. Like, perfection is never interesting. If something isn't flawed, it kind of rings untrue. Because,
well, isn't that what Superman is?
Well, yeah, exactly. Superman is kind of the ultimate example of that. He's like the perfect Boy Scout who's like, oh yeah, America, and he's invulnerable and he has laser eyes and he can do anything. It's just perfection layered on perfection. And
see, that's why I actually found I'm not a hater of Man of Steel, because I kind of like that he seemed to struggle through life.
Yeah.
I think that's actually a positive aspect.
That was good. But then the whole letting people die thing, I don't know about
collateral
that.
Collateral damage, man.
Yeah, no. Like, I go back and forth on that a lot, and it's just like, if they're really nailing the character, at that point in his life, after being raised by the Kents and understanding humanity and everything, he would never knowingly allow people to come to harm. So that scene where Zod throws the tanker at him, and he just leaps out of the way and lets it blow up
okay,
at a building.
Okay, I'll give you that. That was
like,
bad. That was
no,
bad.
No. Superman would never do that. Superman would literally stand in front of it and let it blow up in his face rather than let someone possibly die. Like, that's why I'm kind of hopeful that maybe there's some kind of character development that comes out of it in Batman versus Superman.
Well, it seems to be looking that way, because you can tell just in the trailer how angry Bruce Wayne is at Superman. Like, he wants to destroy him.
He
actually says to Alfred, like, pretty much, we have to kill him.
Yeah.
Like, we can't let this being, this being who has, you know, indestructible powers go unchecked.
Yeah, it seems that way.
Especially that I love that scene in the trailer where you actually see, apparently Bruce Wayne is in Metropolis or was in Metropolis at that point, watching this devastation. You can see how angry he is.
In fact, they line it up exactly with the scene where Zod's attacking Superman with his laser eyes. Like, you can, like, Bruce is literally standing there in the scene where Zod's just going, like, he's just looking around wildly as lasers come out of his eyes. So it, like, matches up nearly exactly with that. I'm going to reserve judgment until it comes out. I'm hoping that there will be something kind of meaningful, like an actual payoff. Like, yeah, he kind of dropped the ball here. And he eventually learns that he has to protect people.
See, that would be good, because that means he is flawed.
Yeah, and that would be interesting. But part of me worries that maybe it's just because they're not good at this. Because DC just has not been good at building their superhero universe at all.
I have no idea how they're going to fit Aquaman and Wonder Woman and Cyborg into this Batman versus Superman movie.
Oh,
like,
God.
I can't even imagine how that's going to all, like, work together.
Yeah, I really don't know. I mean, Wonder Woman might kind of make sense, like, because normally she shows up because she's on this quest from Themyscira to, like, investigate the world of men, etc. So
the only thing I can think of is maybe if this is actually a lead up to a Justice League movie.
Oh yeah,
because that, aren't the three of them, even Cyborg, isn't he in the Justice League?
Yeah, they're,
maybe it's like Batman's like at the end's like, I need some help.
Cyborg's not canonically one of the founding members of the Justice League, but I guess he could be in this continuity.
Now, is Batman the CEO of the Justice League?
No, the three core founding members of the Justice League are usually Batman, Wonder Woman, and Superman. And the Flash. The Flash is usually in there, and Martian Manhunter, but I don't know how many of those they're actually going to get around to introducing. I know they have been talking about doing a Flash movie that is not connected to the Flash TV show. So it would be a completely different Flash, which is weird because Marvel's doing such a good job of threading TV and movies together that DC suddenly is like, oh yeah, we're doing a Flash movie and it's not the same Flash as the show you've been watching for the past 3 years. Our bad. Sorry. You'll just have to enjoy this new actor who's totally different.
They need to get their act together. I was always hoping that they would get more involved with TV. I mean, it seems like they've made some inroads into that, you know, with Arrow and with Flash, but they have, now I have not seen it, so I'm only judging based on what I've heard from other people and some of the short trailers and video clips I've seen. Gotham doesn't make any sense to me.
Oh, no.
The way, what they've done with the ages of the
really
characters...
It really makes no sense at all.
Like, Batman is, what, 12 in that show? And then Penguin is, like, in his late 20s in show? Like, so by the time he's Batman, like, Penguin's an old man. That doesn't make any sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's really, really bizarre. The only way I think it could maybe make sense is if Bruce becomes Batman in his 20s. That's the only way it makes sense. So like season 4 or season 5, he becomes Batman or something. That's the only way I could see it really working. Because otherwise, yeah, like a lot of these villains are going to be old people by the time Bruce becomes Batman. It's a little ridiculous. Like the Riddler is late 20, 30-year-old working at the GCPD. It's like, ugh, why? And then they keep making oblique references to other villains. Like, they had this kid who was basically the Joker, but he died, so he's not the Joker. But then people saw him on TV and they started laughing like one of them could become the Joker, maybe. Yeah. If you ignore standard Batman continuity, it's kind of a good show. But if you keep all of that in the back of your head, you're just constantly like, what the hell are they doing?
I've read Batman Year One, but I don't remember them ever revealing exactly how old he's supposed to be.
Mm.
Have you read Year One?
No.
Okay.
I haven't.
See, now I don't know in the comics. Like, I always felt like I kind of made an inference from the fact that he goes to college / or university, I would assume in his early 20s. So he's still a really young guy and he studies criminology and then leaves university to, you know, study martial arts and whatnot and the League of Assassins and all that sort of stuff. It's plausible that he would be Batman before he's 30, I guess.
Maybe.
I mean, but he would be in his late 20s at that point, probably.
Yeah.
Because it would take years to get that level of training, to not only the training, but to actually, like, physically build up, like, an athletic body.
Yeah.
Like, he would have to invest a lot of time. You don't become, like, a expert black belt in, like, multiple different martial arts in the span of, like, a couple of years. This doesn't happen.
Yeah.
Unless he's, like a prodigy or something.
Well, I mean, he is pretty smart and everything, but no. I think the minimum possible age for Bruce Wayne to be Batman for Year One is probably 27. That's probably like the absolute minimum age for him to start out. Because, yeah, going through university and everything, becoming really smart, becoming the world's greatest detective, going through all that martial arts training, traveling the world. Like, he literally travels all around the world, learning from various people and so on and so forth. So that takes at least 4 or 5 years, plus 3 years for school. So, yeah.
I don't remember if he ever actually graduates university with a degree in that stuff, because in the Nolanverse, which is completely different, he drops out, right? Or he ends up leaving.
Yeah. The Nolan Batman is actually kind of interesting because, yeah, he just kind of falls off the grid and becomes a criminal and then eventually suddenly decides to be awesome and then can suddenly run Wayne Enterprises perfectly. I mean, yeah, some of that didn't really make sense if you stop to think about it.
Well, a lot of it doesn't make sense. But
yeah, I don't see how Gotham's timeline really works at all. Like, I think they're just playing with it like a sandbox. And at some point, they're just like, okay, we give up. Like maybe the series finale is just like, he becomes Batman. And then we don't get to see anything after that. That's probably how it ends, I think. because by the time he becomes Batman, they just it just wouldn't work.
Well, how old is Edward Nygma in Gotham? You said he was in his 20s?
Yeah, I think he's in his mid to late 20s in Gotham.
Mid to late 20s, okay. And Bruce is how old? 12?
He's about 12 or 13-ish.
Okay, so there's a minimum of more than a 10-year gap between them. So, 12, 13... So I mean, maybe a 13, 14-year-old gap between the two of them. So if he's, wow, yeah, Nygma is going to be in his, what, 50s? Mm-hmm. By the time he's 27? Hold on. Oh, I don't know how to do math.
We're doing the nerd math. Look out, everyone.
Oh, so Edward Nygma. Oh, actually, he wouldn't be that old. He would be, Bruce Wayne's 27 and he's 15 years older than him. He'd be 42. So that's not bad.
Okay, yeah.
So that's plausible.
That could work, yeah.
If Penguin is in his late 20s now, that would still work. Because even in the animated series.
He doesn't do a lot of fighting. He just kind of waddles around.
And even in the animated series, the way they drew those characters, Bruce Wayne always looked younger than the Penguin and a lot of the other Rogues Gallery members. So I always assumed that he was in his 30s at that point, in his peak.
I think it could work, yeah. If they're going off of the animated series, then yeah, it might actually line up. And then the Joker hasn't happened yet. Like, that kid was just a kid. And at some point, the Joker happens, but we don't know who. So it's possible that the Joker ends up being somewhere around the same age as Bruce.
I think what's going to be really frustrating is by the time they get to the end of Gotham, assuming that, I don't know what season it's on now. I think it's like 2 or 3.
Season 2.
Okay. So let's even, like, theoretically, this show lasts until season 5. Even if they do have Batman towards the end, do you realize how frustrating that's going to be? Because the series is going to end with him turning into Batman, and you won't get to see. That's when the fun starts.
Yeah,
because I mean, people are watching it because this has characters from the universe. But let's face it, people want to see Batman. You know, I guess, I don't know, how compelling is young Commissioner Gordon?
Well, it's Ben McKenzie, so not bad.
I mean, I'm not judging the actors. The actors all seem like they know what they're doing, but I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, it's
like, you know, that's why I never watched Smallville, because first of all, it seemed like a teen soap opera. Second of all,
it so was.
It just seemed like, this is just such a tease. Like, I want to see Superman.
Smallville was absurd. It was utterly absurd.
Now, I heard with Smallville, they end up showing him in the costume, but it was like the last episode or something.
Yeah.
After 10 years of that show.
The series finale had him.
10 years of that show?
Yeah.
Really?
He became Superman at the end of the series finale. And yeah, that show was just a ridiculous teen soap opera that happened to have superpowers in it. There were love triangles and people constantly doing stuff. And then there was this really bizarre plot line with a witch, and she possessed Lana. And then she tried to kill Lex, and they used kryptonite to get the witch out of her. And yeah,
I saw a picture of, I looked this up. When I heard that they were going to introduce Green Arrow, but he looks nothing like the comic. I mean, even the current DC Green Arrow series looks more like the comic book character than that version, because he had short blonde hair and he was like cleanly shaven and he didn't look anything like the Arrow that I remember. In fact, actually, I'm really behind on Arrow, but the pictures that I've seen of the character, they've evolved the costume. He finally got the mask and the costume has evolved as well, and it looks more and more like the comic book version.
Yeah. And amusingly enough, they've also brought in some Batman characters to Arrow. Ra's al Ghul.
I heard about that. Yeah. Is he any good without giving me any spoilers? Is he the Ra's al Ghul we know?
I haven't actually seen it, so I don't know. Like, I got like maybe 3/4 of the way through season 1 and I never continued.
See, that's exactly what happened to me. And then somebody told me that the writing really picked up in season 2 and 3.
Yeah. Of course, it's going to be really disappointing, because even if these shows are getting really good, they're not going to be tied to the larger DC movie universe. Like, they're effectively keeping them partitioned, which I think is a really bad move, because they can grow them into something so much more.
Well, plus promotion too, right? I mean, getting these people used to seeing these characters, I think, I don't understand the deal or the rationale behind that decision. That doesn't make sense to me. Why wouldn't you want to take every opportunity to promote these characters and have these, I don't know, I just...
I guess DC's angle is they don't want to have to pay the TV actors, movie actor salaries, and then...
There's definitely a big gap between TV actors and movie actors in terms of salary, that's for sure.
I think that's a big part of it, and then it's like the contracts that they would have to draw up, where it's like, okay, you have to be on this many seasons of the show, and then you have to be in this movie, and then appear on another season, and then be in this movie... It would probably be one of the most complicated contracts in Hollywood. It would tie an actor to an entire multimedia storm of content. They would have to appear in everything as this one character for years. And I mean, Marvel kind of has that, but just for movies with their key players. Like Robert Downey Jr., I think, has signed on to be Tony Stark forever. Practically.
I thought he said after Iron Man 3 that he was done with it.
Well, he is and he isn't. I mean, he's in Avengers. He's going to be in Civil War playing quite a large role. Like, Civil War is effectively Iron Man 4, I would say. It's Captain America 3, but also Iron Man 4, but also Avengers 2.5. Because literally every Avenger shows up in it, except for Thor and Hulk, who are both going to be in Thor 3.
I'm so confused right now.
Yeah, it's a little complex. And then, of course, they're introducing Benedict Cumberbatch as Doctor Strange, and then they're going to have whoever they cast as Captain Marvel, and the Inhumans, who have already sort of been introduced in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., but are
going to
have their own movie.
Is that any good?
Oh, yeah, it's really good. Season one kind of drags on for a bit. Then they do the Hydra twist reveal about halfway through season one, and then it starts getting really good. Now it's really good. It is a little hard to watch at first, but it kind of hits its stride once they get, once there's that episode that lines up with Winter Soldier. So like,
is that in season two, or because I heard the first season is kind of like it's got its rough patches.
Yeah, it's about a third of the I think it's halfway to two-thirds of the way through season one. And then you find out that these people worked for Hydra the whole time, blah, 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 blah. Everything goes to shit. And then it starts getting good.
So they acknowledge the fact that... because wasn't it in Winter Soldier that that S.H.I.E.L.D. effectively is disbanded?
Yes. Exactly. So in this episode of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., that all goes down. The fight at the Triskelion happens. Meanwhile, they're fighting for their lives against Hydra, the elements of Hydra that are inside S.H.I.E.L.D. And then a bunch of stuff goes down. And then the remaining episodes of the season are all about evading Hydra and trying to save as much as they can and just kind of hole up and try to protect as many S.H.I.E.L.D. assets as they can. And then season two is kind of about rebuilding S.H.I.E.L.D. and fighting the elements of Hydra that are still out there. And that just kind of really amps up the plot until now in season three, there's just like a ton of stuff going on. Then, of course, there's Agent Carter, which takes place in the past, but is also really cool. Lots of plot threads that are kind of tied to Captain America a bit. The formation of S.H.I.E.L.D., obviously. Season two's looking like it's going to be really cool. They go to Hollywood, and there's like a bunch of intrigue happening with actresses and actors and stuff. They're also going to be introducing Madame Mask, who is a classic Hydra villain. So that should be pretty interesting.
Well, exciting times. And there's so many new Marvel movies in development, properties that have never been done. I know Black Panther is being worked on.
Yep.
And then there's the Luke Cage movie, I think. Or is it going to be a TV series?
They're doing a Luke Cage TV series. Okay, it's going to be out after Jessica Jones.
Okay. All right. So lots of stuff. And I don't know, I haven't heard anything in a while, but I know for years they were trying to develop a Submariner movie, and I don't know what's happened with that.
I don't know if that's going to happen. It's not on the current docket, so I'm not sure. They may be doing a Black Widow movie, though.
That would be about time.
There are two blank slots on the Phase 3 list that could feasibly be a Black Widow movie or something else.
I'd love a, a Justice League TV series. That's what I want to see.
Yeah, I think the problem is they're not willing to invest enough money in a TV series. They want the bang for their buck. They want to do a blockbuster movie that does this many million at the box office. They can't be bothered with a show that might get 10 to 15 million viewers a week. Like, they just don't want to funnel that money in. Marvel, however, they're just throwing money everywhere at everything, and it's paying off. Like, so many people watch Daredevil. So many people are going to watch Jessica Jones. Tons of people are still watching Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and Agent Carter. And, of course, everybody that goes to see every new movie. Like, they have created a cash cow.
Well, who knows what will happen the next couple of years? I mean, we very well may see DC kind of backpedal a little bit. It may be, maybe acknowledge the fact that, you know, Marvel is kicking their butt in Netflix TV. Maybe we will see some Netflix original DC shows. So
it would be nice.
I don't see that. I don't see that as something that's too far off, because if Marvel continues to see the success that they're seeing now with what's currently available, just imagine what they're going to feel it. They're not going to feel good about that.
Well, yeah, if they keep going down this path, keep making these lackluster movies that don't do well, that bomb, it's going to get to the point where I think they started doing really badly, like when they had the Tim Burton Batman films. Like, that didn't go very well at all, and then they just kind of gave up on the whole thing for years.
Well, actually, even Batman Returns did pretty well. It was really Batman Forever with Joel Schumacher that kind of just destroyed that IP for quite a few years.
Yeah, and then, I mean, they tried to do a bunch of Superman movies. There was that one that they tried to do with Tim Burton and Nicolas Cage.
Oh, God, that would have been
And then there was that ill-fated Superman Returns, which was really bad, too.
See, I don't remember it being that bad, and I guess I'd have to rewatch it to see it, but I've heard from a few other people that have recently gone back at it, and they didn't think it was that bad, but I don't know. I'll have to see it. I liked Brandon Routh as Superman. I actually thought he made a more ideal Superman. Probably shouldn't get into the discussion now, because it's gonna take a while. Maybe we'll leave it for next week, but maybe that's something we should come back to, because I'd like to get your thoughts on that. Maybe I should actually just go back and rewatch it, and we can talk about that, because I don't remember really what the flaws were in that.
Although
Lex Luthor was a bit of an oddball character.
I never actually saw it. I just know that Lex Luthor built a kryptonite continent, and then Superman lifted the entire thing and threw it in the sun.
I don't remember any of this. It's been so long since that movie has been out. I really need to go back and watch it. And if you haven't seen it, then I suggest you do watch it. Maybe we should make that a project.
Yeah. The Impromptu Movie Club.
Well, I think that's about it for now.
Yeah, I think so. So on that note, thanks for listening, everyone. See you next time.
Thank you for listening to another episode of The Impromptu. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment to leave a rating on iTunes and let your friends know about us. Detailed show notes for each episode are available on our website at theimpromptu.net. You can follow the show on Twitter at The Impromptu, as well as our hosts individually at Zen Impulse for Michael Norton and at Zero Distraction for Alex Knight. As we are entirely listener supported, you can donate to us at theimpromptu.net/donate. All proceeds go towards covering bandwidth as well as equipment upgrades to uphold the highest level of audio quality you've come to expect. We really do appreciate your support, and we look forward to seeing you next time.